Quite why von Röhne exaggerated the Allied order of battle so extravagantly remains a matter of debate and conjecture. He may simply have been covering his back, knowing that if he underestimated enemy strength, he would be in serious trouble. Perhaps, like many purveyors of official statistics, he moulded his numbers to fit what his audience wanted to hear. Perhaps his act of rebellion was just another skirmish in the bitter internecine battle within German military intelligence. What is certain is that von Röhne was bitterly opposed to the Nazi regime and actively plotting to oust Hitler, whom he detested. He had already played an important part in Operation Mincemeat in 1943 by giving the firm stamp of approval to documents he had every reason to distrust. Some historians believe von Röhne was deliberately sabotaging the German war effort from within. His precise motives may never be known, because Hitler, when he discovered von Röhne's disloyalty, had him murdered. Roger Michael's purpose was possibly more straightforward. After the war, unlike most officers of the German General Staff, Michael was quickly released. He was said to have been seen in Heidelberg, wearing an American Army uniform, and claiming to be part of the US Counterintelligence Corps. He then vanished, having apparently defected to the Soviet Union. He was never seen again. The cheery, rugby-playing, half-English Major Michael may have been a spy for Britain, America, or the Soviets, or conceivably, all three. Piece by piece, the double agents dropped the pieces of the jigsaw into the hands of FHW, where they were slotted together in the ever-expanding projections of von Röhne. Chernovsky reported the 4th U.S. Armored Division in Bury St. Edmunds. One of Garbo's Welsh Aryans saw the 6th Armored Division in Ipswich, while another spotted the 28th Infantry Division in Kent. Puyol himself reported troops of the 83rd Infantry Division gathering in a Dover car park. Lilly sent a wireless message confirming that the 1st U.S. Army was serving under Montgomery, to reinforce the idea that U.S. troops could serve under British command and vice versa. Bronx was vaguer, but the very insouciance with which she relayed her information lent it greater force. To Newmarket for the races. Expected invasion has produced political unity. Many U.S. troops in East Anglia. On May 18th, as planned, Chernovsky told his handlers that he had joined Fusag itself. Henceforth, he would be able to relay the fake order of battle from within the fake army. The loss of the tricycle network, wrote Masterman, meant that a heavier burden had to be carried by Brutus. He lifted it with ease. Puyol told Kulenthal he had obtained a job in the Ministry of Information and now had access to propaganda documents intended to hide the facts in order to trick us that would offer new insight into the Allies' real intentions. Wolf Schmidt, Agent Tate, was the longest-serving double agent of all. But B1A had doubts about using him, largely because his handlers communicated with Berlin by telephone, and there was therefore no way to check his status through most secret sources. Even so, it was decided to move him, in German minds, from a farm in Hertfordshire to another in Kent, where he could observe the deployment of the fictional Fusag at first hand. Have found first-class lodgings with elderly couple in Y, he told his handler. So far as I can see, ideal for radio purposes. Von Röhne was too busy adding weight to his already bloated order of battle to wonder why three key agents had suddenly, and almost simultaneously, moved into positions where they had access to the highest-grade information. Perhaps, through his monocle, he turned a blind eye. At the Expeditionary Force headquarters, Fleetwood Hesketh and Harmer moved their fake units to where they wanted them to be in German mines. The double agents passed the information on, bit by bit, to the Germans, and von Röhne and Michael reassembled the map and passed it up the military chain to Hitler. The pins on the board at the intelligence office in Zussen were massing in the right places, but MI5 remained fretfully aware that if Jebsen cracked, and Double Cross was revealed, von Röhne's projections, built up from the spies' reports, would show exactly where the Allied armies were not assembling. Guy Liddell was certain that once the Gestapo went to work on Jebsen, he would eventually crack, under duress. Ian Wilson scanned the intercepts with dread. If Jebsen's friends and associates were rounded up, If his Abwehr colleagues were interrogated, if Popov's brother was arrested, then that would prove the game was up. The moment Jebsen revealed that the double agents were all part of a grand sham, the evidence would crackle like lightning across most secret sources. Incompetence was a crime under Hitler's rule, and guilt came by association. Kulenthal, Kliemann, Reiler, Bleyl, and von Castorf would all find themselves hauled in to explain how they had been hoodwinked for so long. Everyone Jebsen knew would be considered suspect and probably arrested. Wife, lovers, friends, even Mabel Harbottle. The bloody retribution would start immediately and be reflected in the intercepts. Here was cold consolation. If Double Cross was laid bare, at least they would know it. At first, most secret sources were mute, save for some baffled inquiries from German officials in Lisbon who were not privy to Operation Dora, wondering where Jebsen had gone. But within a week of the kidnapping, it became clear that an interrogation must be underway, as a flurry of messages were intercepted relating to Jebsen's financial activities. Berlin asked Madrid to report that a 2.7 million Moroccan francs, which Johnny is alleged to have remitted to Tangier, have been received. This was followed by an even more cryptic message from Schreiber to Berlin. French money Dora can be received to the full amount through Dora friends here. Furthermore, we may also count on receiving shortly through Dora friends here the original material about Dora which was asked for by his fat friend. Dora was a reference to the kidnapping, and his fat friend was probably Hans Brandes. But the only thing to be deduced with any certainty was that Jebsen's finances were being probed, and large sums of money were involved. Berlin was also trying to trace the cash handed to Jebsen for Popov. After 2 weeks, Ian Wilson reported that there was still no evidence to prove conclusively what effect the return of artists to Germany has had. Encouragingly, there was not yet a general roundup of Jebsen's contacts. Freak's control station in Germany was still sending messages on the agreed frequency. If the Germans were trying to get in touch with Popov, then they must still trust him, which might indicate that Jebsen had not betrayed the network. Unless, of course, that was just what the Germans wanted the British to think. Wilson allowed himself a glimmer of hope. The references in most secret sources, he wrote, are consistent with the theory that Artist was taken to Germany so that his financial dealings could be probed, and for fear that at some future date he might come over to the Allies. If he has confessed, one would have expected that some of the Abwehr officials closely connected to Artist and Tricycle would have ceased to carry out their normal functions, like breathing. Wilson began to wonder if, by some miracle, Jebsen could yet be rescued. Hans Brandes had betrayed him. Perhaps he might now be bribed, beguiled, bullied, or blackmailed into saving him, or at least providing information on what had become of him. Might now be the moment to revive Kim Philby's idea of recruiting this horrible man to British intelligence? If Brandes could be persuaded to play with us, he could, as well as informing us of the position of Artist, give us a lot of information about what is going on in the inner circles of the Abwehr, and particularly the political struggle, which seems to have resulted in the Abwehr coming under the control of Himmler. I do not regard Brandes as being in the least bit reliable. There is plenty of evidence that Brandes is unprincipled, but if the proposition was put to him that he should reinsure himself with the British, he might accept it. If he reported the approach to the Germans, we would know the fact from MSS. John Masterman stamped hard on this idea. Brandes was a snake, and if he told Berlin that British intelligence was sniffing around, this would reinforce suspicion that Jebsen was a British spy and plunge him into even hotter water. I do not agree with the proposal to approach Brandes, Masterman wrote on Wilson's memo, underlining the word not 3 times. But Wilson was not going to give up on Jebsen. I feel a strong personal sense of responsibility in this matter, he wrote. Wilson liked and trusted Jebsen. He had encouraged him to stick to his mission, and he had lost him. He would make it his own mission to find him. Popov waited anxiously for news. Franod de Bona, no longer transmitting to Germany, was also at a loose end. They distracted themselves in the usual way. When MI5 found out that women of the Auxiliary Territorial Service were being introduced to the clockhouse for immoral purposes, and that there might be security interest involved, Wilson told them sharply to stop drawing attention to themselves in this manner. Unable to play an active part in the deception, Popov fired off letters to Churchill, offering to intercede in Yugoslavia between the forces of Mihailovic and Tito's communists. He was told that while Churchill had a paternal interest in his well-being, he did not want him meddling in politics. He should stay calm, stay put, and stand ready in case there should be news of Jebsen. This was not the time for hasty or violent action. The only course, for the time being, was to take no action and await results. On May 19th, Bletchley Park deciphered a personal message from Georg Hansen to Alois Schreiber in Lisbon. "I wish to convey special appreciation and thanks for carrying out Operation Dora." Schreiber replied that a written report on Dora matters was following by air. Then, just 2 weeks before D-Day, the references to Johnny, Dora, and all the missing money abruptly ceased. Ian Wilson wondered if the sudden silence was ominous. "It seems to me not unlikely that Artist may have been shot, or may have committed suicide shortly after his arrest. Yet he tried to look on the bright side. There is still no indication that Artist has made any confession." Wilson's flicker of hope would have been swiftly extinguished had he known where Jebsen was at that moment. Jebsen and Moldenauer had arrived in Berlin by train, under guard, on May 1st. From there they were driven to the military prison at Wunstorf, near Sossen, and lodged in separate cells, while Georg Hansen made arrangements for their interrogation by legal experts. The SD, however, had already gotten wind of Jebsen's abduction and demanded that Hansen put the captive at the disposal of Kaltenbrunner as soon as possible. A full investigation into another potential defector was exactly what Hansen hoped to avoid. He refused to surrender the prisoners and instructed Kurbat to tell the SD that, as Jebsen was a soldier, he regarded it as a matter within the exclusive jurisdiction of the Abwehr. For several days, Kurbat did his best to place difficulties in the way of Jebsen being handed over. The dispute even reached the desk of Field Marshal Wilhelm Keitel, head of the OKW. Finally, a brusque ultimatum arrived from the SS Obergruppenführer Heinrich Müller, demanding that Jebsen be handed over to the Gestapo at once. Among the murderous sycophants surrounding Hitler, Müller stood out for his brutality. The head of the secret state police, he was a principal architect of the final solution, directed the SS murder squads that followed the German army into the Soviet Union, and personally presented Himmler with evidence of Canaris's links to the anti-Nazi resistance. He loathed anyone with an education. "One really ought to drive all the intellectuals into a coal mine and then blow it up," he declared. And he was not a man who took anything but yes for an answer. The demand to surrender Jebsen had already produced a great deal of ill feeling in the Abwehr, according to Kurbat, but there was no point in arguing with Gestapo Müller. Jebsen was taken into police custody by one Sturmbannführer Schmitz, an aide to Schellenberg, who accused Jebsen of having betrayed the work of the SS to the Abwehr, and consigned him to a cell in the notorious Gestapo prison on Prince Albrechtstrasse to await interrogation. Jebsen had often hinted to his British handlers that he was involved in shady business deals with high officials. Indeed, he had told Marie von Gronau he had so much information on the SD, they would not dare investigate him. But his financial chicanery, it seems, went far beyond the forgery scam that had first put him on the wrong side of the Gestapo. Jebsen had been using diplomatic bags to smuggle money from one occupied country to another, and engaging in large-scale manipulations of currency and gold, with the connivance of high-ranking officers, who got a cut of the profits but had since got into difficulties because it became apparent they had more money to spend than could be justified by their apparent incomes. In addition, some senior SS and Gestapo figures had used Jebsen as an unofficial banker. certain sizable sums of money have been given to Jebsen, who deposited the sums in such a way as to render the sums inaccessible. He was also back in the forgery business. Some SS officials had been printing foreign currency, and he had exchanged it for gold value. He was now suspected of having made too much profit for himself, and the SS wanted to remove him for knowing too much. To cap it all, he was accused of improperly converting SD monies for his own use. Jebsen was nothing if not bold in his financial corruptions. He had contrived to diddle senior officers in each of the three most brutal elements of the Third Reich, the Gestapo, the SS, and the SD, and they were out for his blood. MI5 was right to believe that Jebsen was being investigated for his financial dealings, but wrong to assume that this was the only, or even the main, reason he had been kidnapped. Müller was in no doubt that Jebsen was a British spy. Schellenberg confirmed in a post-war interview that Jebsen had been accused of working for Britain. According to Eduard Weitjen, an Abwehr officer working for American intelligence, Jebsen had been tipping off members of the anti-Nazi resistance when they were about to be arrested. Because of good connections, he helped many people who had difficulties with the Nazi organization, Weitjen testified. By his warning, many people were saved. Kurbat's post-war testimony also confirms that Jebsen was suspected of conspiring with the British and planning to defect. The extent of that guilt was as yet undetermined, but Müller and his thugs intended to find out. The two officers in charge of Jebsen's case were SS Standartenführer Eugen Steimler and Obergeheimrat Quitting. They went to work on Jebsen at once. The Gestapo prison at 8 Prince Albrechtstrasse, the neoclassical former Museum of Decorative Arts, consisted of 39 basement solitary cells and one communal cell. Torture was conducted in specially equipped rooms in the upper floors. The term verschärfte Vernehmung, or sharpened interrogation, had been coined by Müller himself in 1937 to describe the torture techniques used on communists, Marxists, saboteurs, terrorists, members of the resistance movement, asocial persons, Polish or Soviet persons who refused to work. By 1944, the extraction of confessions had been refined to a vicious art. Müller's Gestapo torturers were masters of the electrode and rubber nightstick, the genital vice, the soldering iron, and the ice-cold bath, in which prisoners were thrust to the point of drowning. Captured members of the French resistance were told to try to resist torture for at least 24 hours. The Gestapo boasted that in 48 hours they could squeeze any man or woman dry. Gestapo interrogation records were destroyed before the end of the war. The only evidence of what happened to Jebsen comes from a handful of witnesses, post-war interviews, and the testimony of other prisoners. Karl Weigand, an Abwehr officer in Madrid, was summoned to Berlin to discuss the interrogation of Jebsen and returned, according to colleagues, in a highly nervous condition and mentioned something about the unpleasantness of having one's fingernails torn off. Hjalmar Schacht, once Hitler's trusted economist, who was arrested on suspicion of resistance activities, briefly occupied the cell next to Jebsen. According to Popov, Schacht caught a glimpse of Johnny once as he was being brought back from an interrogation. His shirt was drenched with blood. As the guards were about to lock him in his cell, Johnny turned to them, haughty as ever, saying, "I trust I shall be provided with a clean shirt." A former Abwehr colleague who visited Jebsen in prison, itself a brave act, described Jebsen as looking like a typical concentration camp victim. Jebsen was never a physically robust man, with his varicose veins and rattling smoker's cough, but after the attention of the Gestapo he was barely recognizable. His flesh and muscle had melted away, and his head looked enormous, sitting on top of his wasted neck and shoulders. Torture works, but it does not always work, and it doesn't work on everyone, and sometimes it extracts information that is wrong. "Violence is taboo," wrote Robin Tin-Eye Stevens, who ran Britain's wartime interrogation centre in London. Not only does it produce answers to please, but it lowers the standard of information. A person in terror and pain will often tell their torturers what they imagine they want to hear, just to stop the agony, just for a while. Johnny Jebsen knew much that Steimler and Quitting wanted to hear. For a start, the details of his various business dealings. Merely offering up the names of officers implicated in his scams would have provided Müller with useful ammunition and bought, perhaps, some respite. He could have confessed to everything he had told MI6 about Hitler's secret weapon, the workings of German intelligence, and even his suggestion that the wife of P.G. Woodhouse would make a good spy. The Gestapo, the SS, and the SD would have been more than interested. He could have revealed that Popov was a double agent, and that every German spy in Britain was either turned or invented, by admitting that he had identified them all to the British and they were still functioning. He could have told them enough to reveal the truth about the looming invasion and change the course of the war. But by May 20th, with less than 3 weeks to go until D-Day, he had told them nothing at all. 23. Bronx gets toothache. As D-Day approached, MI5 told Winston Churchill that Jebsen seemed to be holding out. There is still no indication that Artist has made any confession, or that the Abwehr have come to realize the true position, wrote Guy Liddell. In further evidence that the deception remained on track, the Germans continued to shower the double agents with praise, encouragement, and even medals. When Agent Tate transmitted his 1,000th message, the Prime Minister was informed he took the opportunity of referring to this fact and expressing his loyal devotion to the Führer. A cordial reply has been received, and it is hoped that this will be followed up by the further advancement of Tate in the Order of the Iron Cross, of which he already holds the first and second class. The case officers were now competing for German decorations. Eddie Chapman, Agent Zigzag, had been awarded the Iron Cross. Agent Tate might get as many as 3. Jebsen had promised Wilson his War Merit Cross. Hugh Astor believed Brutus deserved a decoration and began actively lobbying for a Nazi gong. He suggested that Chopin, Brutus's fictional wireless operator, send a message to Oscar Reiler, recommending that Agent Hubert be awarded a medal, since this would remind the Germans Brutus is running great risks and working under great difficulties solely for ideological motives. Astor drafted a message in what he hoped was the style of a not very intelligent old man. Colonel, please forgive me for troubling you with a personal matter. Hubert would never forgive me if he got to learn about it. He has made great personal and financial sacrifices in the interests of our work. He frequently works until the early hours of the morning preparing lengthy reports. He has mentioned casually to me the daring exploits which he has carried out in order to obtain the information, and I am sure that his honor would be more than satisfied if you could recommend him for some decoration. Wireless intercepts showed that the Germans thought Lily Sergeyev's wireless was functioning flawlessly. Her messages were being conveyed word for word to the intelligence analysts at Zossen. By comparing her original message with its coded repetition on the German intelligence network, the cryptanalysts at Bletchley Park could break that day's code almost immediately. The messages of Treasure and Brutus are being so consistently relayed verbatim on the German WT wireless network that, with the assistance of this crib, there has been a very considerable saving of time and manpower in deciphering most secret sources. For the first time, a note of excited pride crept into the report to Churchill. The double-cross agents, he was told, have, at a critical moment, acquired a value which it is scarcely possible to overestimate. But just as this upbeat assessment was handed to Churchill, fresh disaster loomed in the shape of a small, dead dog. On May 17th, Mary Shearer took Lily Sergeyev to see Gone with the Wind in the West End. Lily's kidneys ached, and she was running a temperature. She had convinced herself once again that she was dying. Mary decided she needed a treat. Both women wept copiously during the film and emerged red-eyed and in high spirits. "I always cry in the cinema," said Mary. They linked arms as they walked home. In her diary, Lily wrote, "Mary crying at the cinema. Is she human after all? This Mary with whom I've been working for 7 months, trying to discover some signs that she is a living being and not an automaton?" Perhaps it was this newfound amity, or perhaps her premonition of impending death prompted the revelation, or perhaps, frankly, she didn't give a damn. But the next morning, as they were preparing another wireless message, Lily leaned over with a conspiratorial air and observed that if she should die, Mary should not try to work the transmitter without her. Mary, suddenly alert, asked her what exactly she meant by that remark. Lily, realizing she had revealed too much, was defensive and dug herself in deeper. "I didn't mean to warn you. I'm not concerned about what happens to your people. I don't owe them anything. I trusted them. You know the result. But I have told you now. You are warned." With a flush of horror, Mary understood that this was not a warning, but a thinly veiled threat. Lily must have been given a control signal after all. Otherwise, why should they not run the transmitter without her? Indeed, she might already have alerted Kliman that she was being run as a double agent. Mary was appalled, and suddenly very worried. "The landing is very near, and thousands of lives depend on our ability to deceive the Germans. Why do you suppose I have told you all this?" asked Lily. Mary knew the answer. "You were very fond of Babs." She demanded that Lily describe her control signal and reveal whether she had used it. Lily refused on both counts. "You can go through all my transmissions with a mathematical genius, but you won't find it." "You realize I must warn Colonel Robertson," Mary said. She immediately sent a message to the head of B1A that was short, precise, and deeply alarming. Sergeyev made a statement to the effect that when she visited Lisbon, she fixed up a control signal with Kliman, which she had not told us about on her return. She had meant, on her return, to get the WT working well and then blow the case. She confessed that her motive was revenge for the death of her dog, for which she considered we were responsible. On return from Lisbon, she had changed her mind about blowing the case. She refused to divulge what the signal was. Tar Robertson was not merely displeased. He was scorchingly furious. Lily was holding Operation Fortitude to ransom over a dog. She might have alerted the enemy already, but as she refused to divulge the signal, there was no way of checking. Kliman's messages of congratulations might be bluffs, and if the Germans had realized Lily was passing over deceptive material, they would compare the thrust of her messages with information from the other agents, spot the similarities, and find out the truth. Robertson faced a dreadful choice. If he shut down Treasure's wireless, and she had not warned Kliman she was controlled, it would immediately arouse German suspicions while depriving Bletchley Park of its useful crib at a time when breaking the codes quickly was vital. But keeping the channel open would be a dangerous gamble, since he had only Lily's word, whatever that was now worth, that she had genuinely changed her mind about wrecking the deception. But however fickle she might be, Treasure was too enmeshed in the deception to be extracted now. Mary wrote, "In spite of Sergeyev's confession, she should carry on operating her WT herself. However, the nature of her traffic would have to be altered, and anything of a deceptive nature would now be out of the question." An emergency plan was drawn up. "We see no particular object in having a showdown with her at this moment," wrote Little. The showdown would come later. Lily would be kept under surveillance. Her past and future transmissions would be closely monitored for any evidence of the control signal. Her telephone would be tapped. A radio technician would stand by, ready to take over and mimic her radio fist at the first sign she had alerted Kliman. And then, as soon as D-Day was over, Lily would be admonished, fired, and quite possibly arrested. She had deceived her case officers, conspired with the enemy, and perhaps tipped off Kliman, putting countless lives in jeopardy for reasons of personal pique and in retaliation for a dog killing that might or might not have taken place. The double-cross team, so confident in its report to Churchill, was plunged back into a state of roiling insecurity. On top of the continuing uncertainty over Jebsen's fate, Now came the gnawing fear that Lily was lying, and Cleeman, tardy, inept Cleeman, might be stringing them along. Since Lily was working her own radio, she might yet be able to wreck the operation. "Treasure is in a position to blow her case to the Germans at any time she wishes to do so," wrote Liddell. "She is a very temperamental person. Although her statement may not be true, it shows she is unreliable." The Tricycle Network had already been shut down as a means of deception, and now Treasure had been taken out of the equation too. That left Garbo, Brutus, and Bronx. On May 27, 1944, Antonio Manuel de Almeida, director and general manager of the Banco Espírito Santo in Lisbon, received a telegram in French from one of the bank's London clients. It read, "Envoyez vite 50 livres. J'ai besoin pour mon dentiste." Send £50 quickly. I need it for my dentist. Señor Almeida knew that this particular client was always short of money. He knew, too, that any message relating to her doctor or dentist was intended for the Germans. He immediately passed the telegram to the German intelligence station on Rua Buenos Aires. From Lisbon, the message passed to Hauptmann Schlüter in Cologne, then to Berlin, and from Berlin to Zossen, where Elvira de la Fuente Chaudois's telegram would be interpreted not as a dental emergency, but as a warning. "I have definite news that a landing is to be made in the Bay of Biscay in 1 week." On the day she sent the telegram to Lisbon, Elvira wrote a letter in secret ink that would arrive in Lisbon after D-Day, ex post facto evidence that her tip-off had been genuine. It was one of Bronx's finest confections. "After a cocktail party, I stayed on at the 400 Club with Captain David Ormsby Gore. After having a good deal to drink, he told me that I should hear some startling news on the wireless the next day, as there was to be an airborne attack on the U-boat base at Bordeaux, preliminary to the invasion. Yesterday he came to see me, very much upset, and asked me to swear not to repeat anything, as he had been drunk, and now the attack had been postponed by a month, and if I repeated the conversation, I would endanger thousands of lives. I am convinced that he spoke the truth, and have, therefore, decided to send you a telegram to warn you of the raid." David Ormsby Gore was a figure of profound respectability. Son of a baron, grandson of a marquis, and great-grandson of a prime minister, he was an officer in the Royal Artillery serving in a secret reconnaissance unit with airborne troops and special forces. After the war, he became an MP, an ambassador to the United States, and a peer. He was a pallbearer at Robert Kennedy's funeral. He supplied John F. Kennedy with Cuban cigars, brought in by diplomatic bag. Elvira had never clapped eyes on him. He was not a heavy drinker, and would never have been so imprudent as to discuss an imminent invasion with someone like Elvira. He was press-ganged into the fiction. He had no choice in the matter. David Ormsby Gore died in 1985, a pillar of the British establishment, wholly unaware that he had taken part unwittingly in tipping off the Germans to an invasion that never was. On the day Elvira sent her telegram to Lisbon, Major Ignacio Molina Perez, Spanish liaison officer and spy for the Germans, was looking out of a window of Government House, Gibraltar, into the courtyard below, when he saw a large car draw up, out of which hopped an instantly recognizable figure, wearing battle dress and famous beret. He was greeted by the governor, Lieutenant General Sir Ralph Rusty Eastwood. With the window open, Molina could hear every word.
"Hello, Monty. Glad to see you," said Sir Ralph.
"Hello, Rusty. How are you?"
said Lieutenant Clifton James, until recently a star on the Leicester variety stage. Molina had been invited to Government House to discuss routine business with the colonial secretary, who had stepped into the next room, the better to allow Molina a free view of the courtyard. His interest in happening on this significant scene was too great to hide, reported the colonial secretary, who, when quizzed by Molina about what Montgomery was doing in Gibraltar, with well-feigned embarrassment, was forced to confess that the commander-in-chief was on his way to Algiers. James was suffering an attack of stage fright, but he played his difficult part with an expert skill, MI5 recorded. He had breakfast with the governor, who congratulated him on his performance and told him, "You are Monty. I've known him for years." Then, with perfect stage management, His Excellency was handing General Montgomery into his car at the very moment Molina emerged from the building. The spy sped away in his own car and was observed making an urgent trunk call in the Spanish town of La Línea. The material reached Berlin in 20 minutes, MI5 estimated. Molina even embellished his own role, telling one of his confidants, who happened to be a spy working for the British, that he had shaken hands with Montgomery himself. "The governor introduced me to him. He seems muy simpático." This informant, who rejoiced in the codename Pants, reported that Molina was very satisfied with himself. The next day, Bletchley Park intercepted a message from Madrid to Berlin that read, "General Montgomery arrived Gibraltar. Discussions held with governor and French general." The British had a double agent working in Algiers airport, codenamed Jail, a former wireless operator for the Free French. Jail informed Berlin of Monty's arrival in Algiers and his reception by General Maitland Jumbo Wilson, the Supreme Allied Commander in the Mediterranean. German reviews of the performance, as revealed in most secret sources, were uniformly positive, and a subsequent report by von Röhner concluded that the presence of Monty in North Africa might point towards additional operations in south of France, in addition to the main invasion. Little wondered if the masquerade had been performed a little too early, but German intelligence seemed satisfied that Monty was still in North Africa on May 28th. If he was there, then he could hardly be organizing a massive assault across the Channel. The plot had gone through from start to finish without a hitch, and we knew that the main feature of its story had reached the Germans, MI5 reported. Clifton James found playing the part of Monty extremely stressful. He was taken to a safe house in Cairo, where he remained, with a copious supply of whiskey, until the Normandy landings were underway. Like all method actors, he struggled to get out of character. He was under terrible pressure and strain, said the wife of an intelligence officer, detailed to look after him as he decompressed following the performance of his life. Coming out of that part was very difficult for him. On the sunny afternoon of May 27th, Adolf Hitler had tea with one of his favorite guests in the Berghof, his chalet in the Bavarian Alps above Berchtesgaden. General Baron Hiroshi Oshima, Japan's ambassador to the German Reich, was a regular visitor to Hitler's private retreat and the Führer's closest foreign confidant. A deep-dyed fascist and fawning Hitler devotee, Oshima had first met Hitler in 1935, when he was Japanese military attaché in Berlin. No one worked harder than the Japanese ambassador to cement the alliance between Germany and Japan. The American journalist, William L. Shira, called him more Nazi than the Nazis. He spoke German fluently and shared Hitler's views on Jews, the iniquity of the Soviet Union, and the need to kill the survivors of U-boat attacks. If Hitler had been able to make friends with a racially inferior being, then he might have counted Oshima as a friend. A professional soldier with formidable powers of recall, after each cozy and informal chat with the Führer, Oshima compiled a detailed update on Hitler's military thinking and planning, which was encrypted and sent by wireless, with German approval, to the Japanese Foreign Office. These reports were read with avid interest in Tokyo and Washington and London. American cryptanalysts had broken the Japanese wireless code in 1940. Using a duplicate of the cipher machine used by Japanese Foreign Office officials, the Allies were able to read the enemy's sensitive diplomatic cables as soon as they were sent. Indeed, the messages were sometimes read by the Allies before they were read in Tokyo, since wireless traffic from Germany to Japan was often held up in transmission. This was the Japanese equivalent of most secret sources, codenamed Magic, an almost miraculous insight into Japan's secrets. Oshima supplied the most interesting reading of all. Some 75 of the ambassador's reports were picked up in 1941, 100 in 1942, 400 in 1943, and no less than 600 in 1944. His commentaries were like having a bug in Hitler's headquarters, only more efficient, since the Japanese ambassador was a military expert with a crisp prose style, who boiled down his conversations with Hitler to the essentials, so Allied intelligence analysts did not have to. Oshima furnished copious information on U-boats, mobile forces, military production, technological developments, the effects of Allied bombing, and the state of the German economy. In November 1943, he was taken on a four-day tour of German fortifications on the Channel coast of France. His resulting 20-page report described the location, strength, and weaponry of every German division, the dimensions of anti-tank ditches, and the layout of machine gun emplacements. If the invaders landed there, he predicted, lateral shell fire from the neighboring posts and the appearance of mobile forces would annihilate them. Allied intelligence agencies could not have produced a better picture of the enemy's defenses had they been invited on the tour themselves. As early as December 1943, Oshima reported that his friend, Joachim von Ribbentrop, Hitler's foreign minister, expected an invasion in Belgium or across the Dover Straits. In January 1944, he informed Tokyo that Hitler was speculating that the Allies might attack Bordeaux, giving hope to Operation Ironside. General George Marshall, the U.S. Army Chief of Staff, paid tribute to Oshima's contribution to the Allied war effort. Our main basis of information regarding Hitler's intentions in Europe was obtained from Baron Oshima's messages from Berlin. If Baron von Rohner was the best way of planting an idea in Hitler's head, then Baron Oshima was the most reliable way of finding out if it had taken root there. Hitler was ludicrously proud of his hideously kitsch, self-furnished chalet at Berghof, purchased with the profits from Mein Kampf. "This place is mine," he told Homes and Gardens magazine in 1938. "I built it with money that I earned." The Führer welcomed the Japanese ambassador into an entrance hall filled with a curious display of cactus plants in majolica pots. Together they strolled down a path to the tea house in the woods. On the way, Hitler remarked that the Japanese government ought to publicly hang every U.S. pilot captured during air raids on Japan. "Our attitude cannot be ruled by any humane feelings," he believed, a view with which Oshima heartily concurred. This was the kind of brutal small talk they enjoyed. Tea was served by members of the SS acting as waiters. The two allies sat on the wooden terrace under a large, colorful parasol, overlooking the Berchtesgaden Valley. "What is your feeling about the Second Front?" Oshima asked. "I believe that sooner or later an invasion of Europe will be attempted," mused the Führer. "I understand that the enemy has already assembled about 80 divisions in the British Isles. Of that force, a mere 8 divisions are composed of first-class fighting men with experience in actual warfare. Does your Excellency believe that those Anglo-American forces are fully prepared to invade?" "Yes. I wonder what ideas you have as to how the Second Front will be carried out." "Well, judging from relatively clear portents, I think that diversionary actions will take place in a number of places, against Norway, Denmark, the southern part of Western France, and the French Mediterranean. After that, when they have established bridgeheads in Normandy and Brittany, and have sized up their prospects, they would then come forward with an all-out second front across the Straits of Dover. We ourselves would like nothing better than to strike one great blow as soon as possible. But that will not be feasible if the enemy does what I anticipate. Their men will be dispersed. In that event, we intend to finish off the enemy's troops at several bridgeheads. The number of German troops in the west still amounts to about 60 divisions." Oshima scurried back to Berlin to write up his notebook. When Oshima's report of his tea-time conversation with Hitler duly arrived in Britain on June 1st, relief flooded through Allied intelligence. In almost every respect, Hitler's assessment mirrored what the framers of Operation Fortitude had hoped for. It gave the first definite assurance that the Germans greatly overestimated our strength, wrote Roger Fleetwood Hesketh, Hitler believed the major assault would come in the Pas-de-Calais, with precursor attacks in Norway and southwestern France. He believed von Rohner's wildly inflated estimates of Allied troop strength. He had faith in the clear portents being fed to Germany by the double agents. He expected a number of attacks at different points, whereas the Allies were even now preparing, in Hitler's own words, one great blow at Normandy. Some were uneasy that Hitler had correctly predicted an attack on Normandy, but he had made clear that he believed this would be nothing more than a diversionary assault, a prelude to the main invasion across the Straits of Dover. Hitler told Oshima he thought an attack would come sooner or later. With 5 days until D-Day, the attack would come far sooner than he imagined. 24. Garbo's Warning. The Allied armies streamed down the country lanes of southern England like water running through numberless rivulets and channels toward the coast, gathering and spreading into a wide estuary of men, weapons, tanks, and ships. The south coast was just unimaginable, recalled Private Fred Perkins of the Royal Berkshire Regiment. It was just one vast marshalling yard of men and materials all the way along. Sergeant Joe Stevens of the Royal Artillery was waiting on the parade ground at Hoyk Camp when Montgomery arrived for a last, sinew-stiffening visit. Monty climbed onto the hood of his jeep. "Gather round me, men," he said. "We're going to Europe. The Germans know we're going to Europe, but they don't know when and where, and this will be the deciding factor. I wish you good luck." Then he drove away. Major Peter Martin led his men past ripening fields toward the coast, wondering at the unreal feeling of marching to war through this gentle, bucolic landscape. Everything was totally normal, and the countryside was gorgeous, and in a few days' time one would be going into an absolute charnel house. Within a week, 7,000 warships and landing craft, 11,000 planes, and nearly 160,000 men would be hurled at the Atlantic Wall, the largest amphibious invasion ever attempted, and the first and naval phase of Operation Overlord, codenamed Neptune. German defences would be pummeled by air and naval bombardment. One British airborne division would try to secure the eastern flank, while American forces would land to the west by parachute and glider. Shortly after dawn, 6 Allied infantry divisions, 3 American, 2 British and 1 Canadian, would storm onto 5 selected Normandy beaches. Eisenhower called it the Great Crusade, but in his pocket he carried a scribbled note, the basis of what he would say if D-Day did not succeed, and his forces failed to gain a satisfactory foothold. In the general's mind, victory was anything but certain. The troops, the air, and the navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do, he wrote in dread anticipation. If any blame is found attached to the attempt, it is mine alone. Before turning in for the night on June 5th, Churchill, haunted by memories of slaughter on the beaches of Gallipoli in the First World War, told his wife, Clementine, "Do you realize that when you wake up in the morning, 20,000 men may have been killed?" As a real army along the southern edge of England prepared for battle, another deployment, even larger but wholly bogus, was underway in 2 quite unremarkable, pebble-dashed, semi-detached houses in the London suburbs. With treasure and tricycle hors de combat, it fell to Brutus and Garbo to ram home the fortitude deception in the hours before D-Day. Mr. and Mrs. Roman Chernovsky had recently moved into 61 Richmond Park Road, Barnes. From here, Agent Brutus drew all the loose threads together. Through his invented wireless operator, Chopin, Brutus laid out the order of battle for the fake army Fusang, with its HQ in Wentworth, under the command of George Patton. In 3 long reports, packed with details supposedly gathered from within the army's operations room at Staines and through tours of Kent and East Anglia, he was able to present the Germans with, as Fleetwood Hesketh put it, the entire chain of command of the Shadow Army Group in southeast England. Patton's army, he warned, gave the impression of being ready to take part in active operations in the near future. While Brutus sketched out the contours of the fake army, on the other side of London, at 35 Crespigny Road, Garbo added the shading and colours. From Scotland came reports of major naval exercises in Loch Fyne, soldiers seen wearing Arctic uniforms, and troops assembling in East Coast ports preparing for an assault on Norway. Garbo reported that his sub-agent in Exeter, one of the Welsh Aryans, had been arrested for lacking the correct documentation in a prohibited zone, a convenient explanation for the lack of intelligence from the southwest. Backing up Bronx's warning of an assault on Bordeaux, Garbo's agent in Liverpool spotted American forces destined for an attack on the South Atlantic French coast in cooperation with another army which will come direct from America. Puyol himself described troops assembling in East Sussex. The Germans were so convinced of Garbo's accuracy that on at least one occasion his report was simply tacked, unedited, onto the German situation analysis. But in case the enemy was unable to reconstruct this imaginary order of battle without help, Garbo, the self-trained military reporter, offered his own conclusions, leading the enemy by the hand to the wrong place. "I conclude that the Harwich-Ipswich area has become an important operational base for future operations," he advised, while news from the north indicates the possibility of an imminent attack against Norway. No one asked him for his opinion. He merely proffered it, and the Germans grabbed it. As the reports poured in from Britain, von Rohner faithfully drew and redrew his map. "The main enemy concentration is showing itself ever more clearly to be in the south and southeast of the island," the German analysts noted on May 15th. Then, 2 weeks later, "further transfer of formations to the south and southeast of the British Isles again emphasizes that the main port of enemy concentration is in this area." By June 2nd, the two-army scheme laid out by Brutus was as good as gospel. According to a reliable Abwehr message of 2nd June, "the forces at present in the south of England are organized into two army groups, 21 English and 1st American. The German spymasters asked for details about the 21st Army Group under Montgomery, the real army, but entirely failed to sense danger in the way their agent seemed so much keener to report what was happening farther east. There is often one much-praised player on a team who fails to perform on the big day. Wolf Schmidt, Agent Tate, the veteran slogger who had clocked up more than 1,000 messages, was not playing at anything like the expected level. He fed the enemy a sustained diet of high-grade deceptive intelligence, but none of it was being swallowed. The bogus units and their locations identified by Brutus and Garbo reappeared dependably in the German military summaries, but for some reason Tate scored a duck. By the date of the invasion, not one of the messages which we had sent through him had found a place in the OKW intelligence summary," wrote Fleetwood Hesketh. Even more worrying than their reluctance to accept Tate's deceptions was the danger that the Germans might believe the fabrications of another informant, which just happened to be correct. Paul Fidrmuch, Agent Ostro, had been inventing reports for the Abwehr since 1940, based on gossip and guesswork. MI5 had long feared that Ostro might hit the truth with his scattergun inventions and, since he was evidently trusted by Berlin, draw the enemy toward the landing site by accident. Sure enough, in early June, Bletchley decoded a message in which Ostro reported that one of his non-existent informants, a colonel on Montgomery's staff, had identified Normandy as the Schwerpunkt. Ostro, in a long message, though entirely inaccurate, has hit on the target area, Liddell wrote in his diary for June 5th. With just 24 hours to go, there was nothing to do but hope that one lucky, accurate falsehood would not be enough to outweigh the great mass of misleading untruths that had already been dumped on the enemy. Shortly before midnight on the eve of D-Day, in deep blackout, a peculiar little procession entered the house at 35 Crespigny Road in Hendon. Leading the way was Juan Puyol, followed by Tar Robertson, Tommy Harris, and Roger Fleetwood Hesketh. Bringing up the rear was Sergeant Charles Haynes, the former bank clerk who operated Garbo's wireless. all wore civilian clothes. Earlier in the evening, they had enjoyed dinner at Harris's home in Mayfair, lubricated with a magnum of Chateau Ozone 1934 from his excellent cellar. Refreshed, eager, and extremely tense, this oddly assorted group was about to commit what was, on the surface, an act of astounding treachery, tipping off the Germans to the time and place of the D-Day landings. Harris had argued strenuously that in order to maintain Garbo's standing with the Germans, Puyol must be allowed to send advance warning of the invasion, not so soon as to make any military difference, but sufficiently early that when the Allies duly landed in Normandy, Puyol would be able to say he had told them so. This was not vanity. The follow-up phase of fortitude, maintaining the threat to the Pas-de-Calais to prevent the Germans from redeploying forces to Normandy, was as important as the first, and sustaining German belief in Garbo's infallibility was crucial. After some hesitation, Eisenhower had agreed that the double-cross team could alert the Germans no more than 3.5 hours before the first troops landed at 6:30 a.m. The delay in transmission from Madrid to Berlin was about 3 hours, so by the time the German High Command got the message, the invasion should be underway. Puyol had told Kulenthal he was expecting important news from Scotland, and asked him to ensure that the wireless operator in Spain was waiting to receive a message at 3 a.m. Number 35, Crespigny Road, was, and is, a perfectly nondescript house on a quiet street in an unremarkable corner of London. It looked like every other house on the road, and a million other houses across Britain, which was, of course, why MI5 chose it. If any building could claim to be a master of disguise, it was this one. But if the house seemed innocuous, unlikely to play any part whatsoever in winning the war, then so did Juan Puyol. He was now all but bald and wore large glasses, which made him seem less like the fighting bantam he had resembled on first arriving in England, and more like a tiny, intensely focused owl. He appeared to be exactly what his neighbours on Crespigny Road thought he was, a shy, polite, foreign gentleman who did something dull at the BBC. Just before 3 a.m., with Allied paratroopers already in action in France, the five men gathered around the wireless in the upstairs bedroom, and Haynes prepared to send the message. The story, as befitted the occasion, was a dramatic one, although buried as usual in Puyol's nomadic circumlocutions. Fred, the Gibraltarian waiter, had linked up with two American deserters from Hiltingbury Camp and gone AWOL in order to bring Garbo the news that the invasion had started. He has told me that 3 days ago, cold rations and vomit bags had been distributed to troops of the 3rd Canadian Division and that the division had now left the camp, its place now taken by Americans. There were rumors that the 3rd Canadian Division had now embarked. The situation of this agent is very compromising because his absence must have been noted due to the many hours which have elapsed since he left the camp. In order to protect the service, that is the network, I have taken a decision to put him into hiding. If the Canadian troops had not returned, that could only mean they had set sail for France, and since Hiltingbury is just 8 miles from Southampton, and Southampton is opposite Cherbourg, then the logical target must be Normandy. The Germans would read the clues instantly. At 2:59, Tarr told Haynes, "All right, Sergeant, let them have it." Haynes keyed in the call sign. The only response was a crackle of static. "I don't get it," said Haynes. "Normally Fritzy answers right away." He repeated the call after 15 minutes. Again there was no reply. The radio operator had either left his post or fallen asleep. Haynes kept calling. Harris observed, "The trouble is, life in Madrid really only begins at midnight. Kulenthal's operator is probably at Chicotes, having a copita with his friends." Robertson and Fleetwood Hesketh eventually made their excuses and went home to bed, like guests peeling off from a dud party. The message was strengthened, adding information that would have breached security a few hours earlier to make the warning more stark and enhance Garbo's standing further. Finally, at 8 a.m., the Madrid wireless operator either woke up or came into work, and the message was picked up and acknowledged, by which time the Canadian 3rd Division was no longer gathering up its vomit bags and preparing to embark, but under heavy fire from the German 716th Division on Normandy's Juno Beach. Far from being an anticlimax, Garbo's carefully timed non-warning had achieved its purpose. He had passed over what must be seen in German eyes as the most important intelligence tip-off of the war, and they had missed it. Like the Madrid radio operator, the Germans had been caught napping. On the afternoon of June 4th, Lieutenant Commander George Honor gingerly maneuvered his midget submarine into its reconnaissance position a quarter of a mile off the beach, codenamed Sword, the most easterly of the landing beaches where, in just 36 hours, the British 3rd Infantry Division was due to attack. He raised the periscope and peered toward the shore. "We saw a lorry load of Germans arrive. They started playing beach ball and swimming, and at the back of my mind I thought, I hope there are no Olympic swimmers, and they don't swim out and find us. There were the Germans having a Sunday afternoon recreation, and little did they know what was sitting and waiting for them." The invasion of Normandy was a military sucker punch. Senior German commanders were not only unprepared, but positively relaxed. Rommel, in charge of improving the Channel defences, was 500 miles away at home in Ulm, celebrating his wife's birthday. Hans von Salmuth, of the 15th Army, defending the Calais area, was on a hunting expedition. The intelligence chief, Colonel Georg Hansen, was taking the waters at Baden-Baden. Divisional commanders in the 7th Army's area had left for a war gaming exercise in Rennes, designed to simulate an Allied landing. The German Navy, having reported that an invasion was improbable, owing to the poor weather, cancelled patrols in the Channel, and the troops in their dugouts and bunkers were told to get some rest. Von Rohner's situation report for June 6th did not even mention Britain and focused almost exclusively on the Mediterranean. The day before D-Day, von Rundstedt, with 1.5 million men of the Wehrmacht under his command, sent out a reassuring situation report. "That the invasion is actually imminent does not seem to be indicated as yet." Even his convoluted grammar suggests a man who thought he had time on his hands. The defenders manning the Great Atlantic Wall were assured of its impregnability, convinced that the enemy would be repulsed, and thoroughly disinclined to get agitated. When a private in the German 7th Army Intelligence Corps informed the duty officer that the front line was reporting an attack, he was told, "Don't make a big production of it. Remember Dieppe," a reference to the failed Allied raid of 1942. Colonel Oskar Reiler, Brutus's wily case officer in Paris, had become an expert in interpreting hidden messages to the French resistance contained in apparently meaningless phrases broadcast in French by the BBC. On June 5th, German intelligence picked up 14 such messages and concluded that the invasion was imminent. The 7th Army in Normandy ignored the warning. The 15th Army at Calais raised its state of alert, but von Salmuth remained catatonically calm. "I'm too old a bunny to get excited about this," he said. Hitler had stayed up late on June 5th, discussing films with Eva Braun and Goebbels. Since the Normandy attack was assumed to be a diversion, it was not thought necessary to wake Hitler and tell him it had started. On D-Day, he slept in until 10 o'clock. When finally told the invasion had begun, he was cheerful, convinced the attack would be repelled with ease. The double-cross team could not and did not claim sole credit for wrong-footing the Germans on June 6th. The bombing campaign in northeastern France had steadily increased until every bomb that landed on Normandy was matched by two dropped on the Pas-de-Calais. Twice as many radar stations were attacked outside the invasion zone as in it. Far behind the lines, parachutists set off flares and fireworks and blasted out recordings of small arms fire to draw German troops away from the landing beaches, while an airborne army of dummy paratroopers compounded the confusion. As the real army ploughed through the waves toward Normandy, two more fake convoys were scientifically simulated heading for the Seine and Boulogne by dropping from planes a blizzard of tin foil codenamed Window, which would show up on German radar as two huge flotillas approaching the French coast. The Germans might have been taken by surprise, but they were far from defenseless. The coastline bristled with field and coastal batteries, mortars, machine guns and snipers, barbed wire, wooden stakes, mines, anti-tank hedgehogs made from welded steel girders, concrete pyramid-shaped dragon's teeth to slow down and channel tanks into killing zones, and more than a million upright stakes in the fields beyond, known as Rommel's asparagus, to impede airborne landings. From bunkers, machine gun nests, trenches and gun emplacements, the German defenders poured fire onto the attackers. At Omaha Beach, the first men to land faced an inhuman wall of fire. More than 2,400 were killed or wounded. At Juneau, the Canadians suffered 50% casualties in the first hour. Beyond Sword Beach, where German forces had played Sunday beach ball a few hours earlier, the Gestapo began reprisals. At the city prison in Caen, 87 members of the French resistance were dragged into the courtyard and shot. News of the landings was brought back to Britain by Gustav, an RAF homing pigeon released by the Reuters war correspondent Montague Taylor. His name might sound suspiciously foreign, said the bird's trainer, Frederick Jackson of Cosham in Hampshire, but he was as English as they come. Montague reported, "The invasion army has thought of everything, including carrier pigeons to carry the big news home if all else fails. A wing commander arrived here only a few hours before I embarked on my landing ship and presented me with a basket of four pigeons, complete with food and message-carrying equipment." At 8:30 a.m., Montague released Gustav. Flying through 30-mile-per-hour headwinds, dense cloud, and sporadic enemy fire, the pigeon completed the journey to his home loft on Thorny Island near Portsmouth in just 5 hours, 16 minutes, a D-Day record. Sergeant Harry Halsey removed the message strapped to Gustav's leg and relayed it to London. "We are just 20 miles or so off the beaches. First assault troops landed 0750, steaming steadily in formation. Lightnings, typhoons, fortresses crossing since 0545. No enemy aircraft seen." D-Day was the reason for the double-cross system, the grand finale to which every preceding deception was a foretaste. The men who fought that day have become lasting symbols of courage and skill. But while they battled their way up the bloody dunes, an unseen force fought alongside them from many miles away, not with guns, bullets and bombs, but with subterfuge and stealth, to whittle away German strength and confidence, to confuse, surprise and mislead, and to shield the invaders with lies. By the end of the first day of the invasion, the Allies had suffered at least 10,000 casualties and 2,500 dead. But 156,000 men had landed in France from the sea and 23,000 from the air, thrusting a spear point into occupied France. What those numbers might have been without the fortitude deception, and what measure of that deception was attributable to the double agents, is, of course, impossible to judge. But this is certain. If the double-cross deception had backfired, if Johnny Jebsen had cracked, if Lily Sergeyev had inserted her control signal, if the great defensive net of lies had unraveled and the Germans had been ready and waiting in Normandy, reinforced and alert, then the invasion would have failed, and D-Day would have ended in a massacre of Allied troops. 25. Second Innings. The 6th of June was the longest day. It had been assumed that, for the double agents, it might also be the last, once the Germans realized they had fallen victim to an elaborate hoax. They did not, and the double-cross team now had a second innings to play, to foster the illusion that another, even larger invasion would soon strike the Pas-de-Calais, and maintain that sham as long as possible. The spies would surely soon be exposed, but every hour that the fiction held, every hour that the 15th Army awaited the fake invasion, could make a critical difference in blood spilled and territory won. The planners hoped the twin threats to Norway and Calais might be maintained for as much as 10 days. Eisenhower would have settled for less. He knew that if even a part of the mighty German army in the north moved its guns to the fragile Normandy bridgehead, the invasion could still fail. "Just keep the 15th Army out of my hair for the first 2 days," he told the deception planners. "That's all I ask." The Double Cross agents plunged back into the shadow battle, following up the D-Day invasion with a volley of apologies from the spies who had failed to give prior warning and a blast of recrimination from the only one who had. Brutus's excuse was that he had been busy finding out about the other army poised to cross the Straits of Dover. Unfortunately, by remaining without contact with 21 Army Group and through awaiting a state of alert at Fusag, I was not able to give you the details of the first landings. Tate was also contrite, pointing out that more troops seemed to be arriving in Kent. As soon as the Normandy invasion was publicly announced, Bronk sent a letter in secret ink, knowing it would not arrive for many weeks, insisting that her prediction of an attack on Bordeaux had been sent in good faith. Distraught by the news of invasion and convinced of the genuineness of the information given by Captain Ormsby Gore. Dined with him last night, but he did not respond to my teasing on the subject of his indiscretion, merely reminding me that I had promised never to speak of it again. Can only suppose there has been a change of plan, or else that this attack also will take place. Garbo, by contrast, took a verbal flamethrower to his German handler for failing to pick up the warning message sent before the invasion began. "This makes me question your seriousness and your sense of responsibility. I therefore demand a clarification immediately as to what has occurred. I am very disgusted in this struggle for life or death. I cannot accept excuses or negligence. Were it not for my ideals and my faith, I would abandon this work. I write these messages to send this very night, though my tiredness and exhaustion, due to the excessive work I have had, has completely broken me." Kulenthal squirmed. He blamed the weather. He blamed Garbo's wireless operator and his own. He blamed anyone but himself, and offered a flood of groveling flattery. "I wish to stress in the clearest terms that your work over the last few weeks has made it possible for our command to be completely forewarned and prepared. Thus I reiterate to you, as responsible chief of the service, and to all your collaborators, a total recognition of your perfect and cherished work, and I beg of you to continue with us in the supreme and decisive hours of the struggle for the future of Europe." Churchill made what he doubtless thought was a helpful contribution by lying to the House of Commons and announcing that the assault on Normandy was the first of a series of landings. The only problem was that Garbo had already reported to Madrid, from his notional perch within the Ministry of Information, that officials had been specifically ordered not to allude to further attacks in order to preserve the element of surprise, and here was the Prime Minister doing just that in the most public way. Puyol scrambled to explain that Churchill's failure to follow the directive had caused consternation, and an investigation was underway. In the end, the Prime Minister's gaffe probably did more good than harm. So far, the double agents had dropped hints of an impending invasion of the Pas-de-Calais. Now they could go all out and boldly state that Fusag was preparing to attack across the Channel at any moment. If the deception before D-Day was composed of subtle hints and nudges, the second phase was spoon-fed to the Germans with a spade. "Fortitude requires a threat to the Pas-de-Calais to be continued indefinitely," wrote Astor, "to contain the maximum number of troops during the next few critical days." Brutus immediately sent a message to Reiller, depicting the Normandy invasion as merely a starter before the main course. "It is clear that the landing was made only by units of the 21st Army Group," he radioed on the evening of D-Day. "Fusag, as I reported, was ready for an attack which is capable of being released at any moment, but it is now evident that it will be an independent action." The agents reported American troops pouring into southeast England, radio traffic was increased, and sabotage in the Calais area was intensified, all pointing to a second army in an advanced state of preparedness for offensive action. Garbo was also categorical.
I never like to give my opinion unless I have strong reasons to justify my assurances, he told Kulintal. This was hardly true, since he gave his opinions all the time, on everything. In the longest message to date, sent from Crespigny Road in the early hours of June 9th, he and Harris laid out exactly what the German High Command ought to think. After personal consultation on 8th June with my agents, I am of the opinion, in view of the strong troop concentrations in southeast and East England, which are not taking part in the present operations, that these operations in Normandy are a diversionary maneuver designed to draw off enemy reserves in order then to make a decisive attack in another place. It may probably take place in the Pas-de-Calais area, particularly since in such an attack, the proximity of the air bases will facilitate the operation by providing continued strong air support. The constant aerial bombardment which the area of the Pas-de-Calais has suffered and the strategic disposition of these forces give reason to suspect an attack in that region of France, which at the same time offers the shortest route for the final objective of their illusions, which is to say Berlin.